This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Gloria Steinem is among the most important figures of the American feminist movement. Her accomplishments as a journalist and activist include co-founding and editing Ms. Magazine, publishing articles about barriers to women's rights, and decades of organizing on the front lines of both national and international feminist movements. Last year, she released a memoir that traces her life story through the experiences she has had on the road. At age 82, she now travels a little less than she used to, but that doesn't mean she intends to stop anytime soon. Gloria Steinem is going to be in the Triangle for events this weekend, but first she joins me for a conversation. Gloria Steinem, welcome to the State of Things. What an honor. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Your memoir paints portraits of both of your parents and your itinerant life. You traveled a lot, and your father took you around quite a bit. Tell us about traveling around as a young girl.
Really, we spent most of the year in a house trailer and trailer camps and going back and forth across the country. But my father had a summer resort in southern Michigan. It was just that he hated the cold weather. So when it got to be Halloween, I would be taken out of school, and my sister, who was 9 years older, would kind of go to high schools along the way. But we would work our way with my father buying and selling antiques and jewelry and so on to Florida or California. So, I didn't realize that I was going to learn from this and repeat this. At the time, I thought I wanted to stay at home like the kids I saw in movies, with a house with a picket fence and a pony. But it turned out, actually, that traveling was infectious.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, so then you were aware, because sometimes if that's what you do, it's the air you breathe, it doesn't seem unusual. But you were aware that this is not normal and, in fact, had aspirations to a more stable life as a result.
Well,
at the
yes,
time.
Because I would go to school, until it got cold. And so I had friends there, and I realized that they were continuing in the usual way. And the movies, of course, are crucial, I think, to all of our childhoods and our ideas of, for better or worse, of what our goal is or what normal is.
You talk about the fact that, especially as you came into your feminist consciousness, you were trying to downplay the role of your father in your life, but ultimately came to embrace that role and understand it more deeply and his contributions. Tell us about that journey.
Well, it wasn't exactly downplaying. It's just that, excuse me, it was so clear that my mother did not have a journey of her own. So when I first started writing about my family, I wrote a long essay called Ruth's Song, because she could not sing it. And it was only later, because my father could do what he wanted to do somewhat more, even though he was a dreamer and the dreams never quite came true. But I didn't feel the compulsion to write about him first. Later I realized, of course, how much he influenced my life and how lucky I was to have a kind, funny father who listened to me and treated me like a unique individual and even a playmate.
Your mother, a pioneer newspaper reporter and a journalist, and tell us about her.
Yes, she came from Toledo, from a working-class family, less well-off than my father, and very intelligent and daring and innovative. So she became a journalist at a time when, in the beginning, she had to write under a man's name in order to get published at all. And she was also getting through the university by tutoring other people in calculus, so which is way beyond me. So I think she really was quite a brilliant woman. And she married my father, who was a kind of happy devil-may-care person who must have been a great relief from her kind of more, more square, down kind
what,
of childhood.
What isn't a relief from calculus, but go ahead.
at the same time that he was a lovely, kind, charming person, he was also super irresponsible about money, and he was always in debt. And meanwhile, they had had my sister, who's 9 years older, and I think my mother just tried very, very hard to keep it all together, but just couldn't. And so ultimately she had what was then called a nervous breakdown and was in a sanatorium for a year or two, I'm not sure. And when she emerged, she just gave up everything she loved and cared about of her own, her work, her friends, the newspaper in Toledo, and moved with my father to rural Michigan, where he was trying to start up this summer resort.
What was the impact of that breakdown on you at the time, and then how did that change, and how has it influenced you as you reflect on it later in life?
Well, the breakdown was actually before I was born, so I didn't become aware of what a unusual career she could have had and did have before I was born. By the time I came along, she was somebody who was, you know, kind and loving and full of love for books and poetry, but also very depressed and very anxious and hooked on an early version of tranquilizers, chloral hydrate, which, you know, was quite powerful. So she was often someone to be cared for, and it took me a long time to realize what might have been for her. You know, I think that, many of us are living out the unlived lives of our parents, and I am, too, living out the unlived life of my mother. And it took me a while to realize that what happened to her was not her fault. It was, in large part, a female fate.
What would she make of this, of your career?
Well, she lived, yeah, you know, to see a lot of it.
Yeah.
And she was very happy, I think, to see me becoming a writer and making a living as a writer, which is what she had wanted to do, to go to New York with her girlfriends and so on, and try her hand at being a newspaper woman. She was very happy about it, but she was also a little scared. I mean, she was very uncertain that I could continue to make enough money to take care of myself. For instance, I would come home to visit her where she was living with my sister and my sister's husband and six kids, and she would say to me things like, "Your sister just got a new winter coat, and she didn't have to pay for it herself." So I think she was fearful but proud.
Well, your book is called My Life on the Road. It is a travel odyssey, both through time and space, but also I think it's an emotional odyssey and an intellectual odyssey. So tell us about that journey and when you first began to understand that you might be, that you would devote a career to women's rights and feminism.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like most of us, I just absorbed the popular wisdom and I assumed that I was working for a while and living my own life for a while before I, quote, settled down, unquote, that I got married and had children and led the life that I was told everybody was supposed to lead. It was only the luck, really, of, first of all, just putting it off in order to do what I loved and do the work I loved. And then the women's movement came along to tell me that not everybody has to lead the same life. You know, we have choices. And I discovered I was happy, you know, as I was. So that was a huge gift. And I began to try to spread that gift so that it was clear that we could honor each other's choices, all of us, women and men, and have a wide variety of choices. And because I couldn't publish what I wanted to about the early excitement of the women's movement, the editors I'd been freelancing for were not interested, to put it mildly. I also discovered something completely new, which is speaking to groups in a room. You know, you can kind of understand each other when you're present with all five senses in a way that, as much as I love books or as much as I recognize the miracle of the web, you can't do unless you're physically present. I never, ever would have realized that because I had avoided public speaking very, very fervently until I was in my mid-30s.
Well, you write about that, and I know you've also spoken about the importance of having biological friends versus virtual friends and how important that is still in your mind in keeping movements alive, not perhaps at the expense of social media, but you do place a great emphasis on it, and I wonder about that. Is the time for that? I mean, you seem committed to it, but is there an argument to be made that it was effective for you decades ago, but maybe the time for that kind of personal, very close, intimate kind of contact is past?
I when none of us knows, right. has all the wisdom, right? But I did ask several neurologists if we could manufacture oxytocin, which is the hormone that floods us when male or female we hold a baby, say, or we see a member of the human species in trouble and we feel compelled to help them, even if we don't know them. That surge of empathy, if that could happen on the screen or on the page. And they all said no, actually. You have to be present with all five senses for that. It doesn't mean that the page and the screen isn't valuable, but it does mean that you can't raise a baby on the web. you can't fully empathize with each other. It's probably part of the reason that we can be cruel to each other on the web in a way we would not be in person.
You had an experience in college that gave you what is your mantra now, ask the turtle. I wonder if you'll tell us that story.
Yes, it took me a lifetime to realize what I'd learned. It was my first year of college. I was taking geology. The professor had taken us out into the Connecticut River Valley. And I was, I'm sorry to say, paying no attention because I had gone up a muddy path to toward an asphalt road and found in the embankment of the road a huge mud turtle, enormous. And it was headed towards the road, so I was sure it was going to crawl up there and get crushed by a car. So I picked it up and, carried this angry, snapping, huge turtle all the way down to the river. And just as I had slipped it in, the professor came up behind me and said, that turtle has probably spent maybe a month crawling up that road in order to lay its eggs in the mud on the side of the asphalt road. Well, I felt terrible, of course, and it was too late. There was nothing I could do, but it took me a long time to understand that this was a first and deep political lesson. Always ask the turtle.
Which you've taken with you, I think, as you organize, and particularly as you move around the globe, this is kind of an organizational mantra for you. Am I right?
And I think it's just common sense, that people who have experienced something are often more expert in it than the experts. And much of the lessened effectiveness of government policy and philanthropy is the problem that comes with making decisions from the top instead of from the bottom up.
Yeah, well, sadly, it's not the – I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, the NGO seems to know better than you, how to get water from your well or something like that. So,
yeah, and I think that we can see that – although there are some things that work that way, perhaps inoculation for certain diseases and, there's some things that can be top down. Most of it really has to be bottom up. Hmm.
You dedicated your memoir to the doctor who performed your abortion when you were 22. Can you tell us a bit about the promise you made to him? Have you kept it?
Yes, I did keep it. And in fact, I kept it so long, I kept it past the time that he obviously could no longer be alive, because he had said to me, since it was quite illegal still in England, that unless you had two physicians signing their permission and saying that this was necessary for the life of the woman and so on, that he would sign it if I promised him two things. One, that I would never tell anyone his name, and two, that I would do what I wanted to do with my life. So, that came home to me. And so I dedicated the book to him. At the end it says, "Dear Dr. Sharp, I believe you, who knew the law was unjust, would not mind if I say this so long after your death. I've done the best I could with my life. This book is for you."
You kept that promise, as you say. You've dedicated the book to him. I wonder what your thoughts are on where the abortion debate stands today.
The anti-abortion people who think that these very intimate decisions should be made by the government, not by individual women and their physicians and families, lost most of what they hoped to gain in Washington. So now they have really been most active in state legislatures, and they are no longer bombing abortion clinics. I mean, they murdered 11 people in the course of their anti-abortion efforts and seemed surprised that this didn't make them popular. So now they are striving in states like Texas and even Pennsylvania and many others to eliminate the ability of clinics to operate by imposing impossible architectural and hospital requirements and so on them. So, you know, we really have to pay attention to our state legislatures. And it could be a good thing in many ways, because the reason that kids are graduating in debt, for instance, is mainly because state legislatures are spending money on building prisons instead of giving it to universities. You know, I mean, we really need to pay as much attention to our state legislatures as we do to Washington.
Conservatives have been quite successful in putting the blame on if you're a poor white worker and you notice you're not doing as well as you should and you can't send your kids to school. It seems to me that conservative rhetoric has been quite effective at putting the blame on things like immigration, feminism, civil rights, that sort of thing. And I wonder where you think feminism is, and if you're focusing on, states like North Carolina, there's a huge section of the population that thinks our prisons should be even bigger. Where's the debate today, and where does feminism fit in that struggle?
You know, I think that the original statement that one group should govern another starts with controlling reproduction and therefore the bodies of women. And that's part of the reason there's a maximum resistance to that. In addition, if you want to continue racist structures, you have to control reproduction in order to keep races distinct. So you see racism and sexism or caste in India, they're intertwined and they go together. We in this country are on the verge of becoming, for the first time, at least the first time since Columbus, a majority European-American or a majority
non-European
people of color,
yeah.
Non-European-American for the first time. And for people who grew up believing that whiteness or maleness or, you know, other elements of the hierarchy gave them a particular place in society, it's quite frightening. I mean, I think in the long run, it is humanizing for all of us because men are being killed literally by the masculine role, by, you know, speeding and violence and tension and so on. The women's movement actually has, we figured out, about 4 or 5 years of extra life to offer men. And our new diversity means we're way more connected to the rest of the world. We'll understand the rest of the world better. But right now there is, you know, because there is a new majority opinion in the country and soon will be a new majority of people of color. I mean, the first generation that is a majority babies of color has already been born. There's a lot of fear and uncertainty. So we have to reach out to each other and understand each other and, you know, say clearly that the old hierarchies were completely artificial and that we'll all be more free when we can be uniquely ourselves and also share our humanity.
Gloria Steinem, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Activist and journalist Gloria Steinem recently authored the memoir My Life on the Road, and you can hear her speak at Meredith College on Saturday at 7 o'clock. She'll also co-facilitate a discussion on violence against women and children at Farrington Barn in Pittsburgh Sunday at 11. And of course, all that information is at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Chris Stamey. Stay with us.